Greetings. You are listening to the Northeast Ohio AFSC Weekly Audio Podcast. It is Friday, October the 23rd. Greg Coleridge here with you for another week of information and analysis. So glad that you have taken a few moments to listen in. We hope this audio resource informs you about issues you feel are important but not hearing elsewhere, updates you about past and upcoming AFSC plans and activities, and inspires you to take action. It is, after all, grassroots social movements made up of well-informed, prepared, and motivated people that always creates real change. Well, we begin this week, as we do every week, with a report of several activities and events that we were directly or indirectly involved in. This past week, beginning with an event this past Saturday on the 17th that took place at the new Max Hayes High School on the west side of Cleveland. Several AFSC board members and myself took part in a forum that was entitled The Rise of the Labor Movement in Ohio, Populism, Socialism, and the Campaign to Amend the 1912 Ohio State Constitution. It was put on by the Labor Education and Arts Project to commemorate the memory of the namesake of the school where we were meeting, Max Hayes, who was a founder and editor of what became America's oldest labor newspaper, the Cleveland Citizen. He was also very active in helping to organize and then participate in the 1912 Ohio State Constitutional Convention and the campaign to amend the old convention to, or old constitution, that is, to make what became the 40-some labor-endorsed issues for consideration of the Constitution in 1912 a much better document. And now, not all of those amendments that Hayes and his labor brethren and other progressives and populists got behind became law, but of the 42, there were, I believe, 34 of them that were passed, including workers' compensation, women's suffrage, efforts to eliminate child labor, the 8-hour workday, and then some of those that we are very familiar with today that are sort of democracy-related, having to do with the initiative, the creation of the initiative, the referendum, and the recall provisions that allow citizens to directly, going around public officials, to create laws in the case of initiatives, to repeal laws in the case of referendum, and to get rid of lawmakers, legislators, through the recall. So 34 of the 42 proposed amendments were in fact ratified by Ohio voters and incorporated into the Constitution. There were several very fine speakers who spoke about labor in general. Mary Treese, who is a professor of communications at the University of Akron, spoke about women in the labor movement. And Stephen Steinglass, who is at Cleveland State University, professor emeritus in the law school, spoke about the, in particular, the initiative provisions, recall, referendum, and how important those have been to promote progressive causes in the state of Ohio. Following a luncheon, the legacy of the 1912 campaign to expand and strengthen democracy through the initiative and referendum and recall were particularly lifted up, with there being speakers that addressed how we can amend today the Constitution and improve things through the initiative. Of course, what was on the minds of many was the state issue currently before voters next month, Issue 2, that would, on its surface, address issues of monopolies, oligopolies, and cartels, but some of us believe is a lot more than that. So there was some back and forth about the pros and cons of Issue 2, a very fine discussion, very good event, and quite a bit that came out of it. I spoke a little bit about Issue 2, why, from AFSC's perspective, we should be opposed to it. I won't get into it. We spoke a bit more about it in depth last week. If you would like to read more about AFSC's position, you can go to our website, afsc.org/Akron, and find the 10 reasons to say no to issue 2, a joint statement that AFSC and the Move to Amend Ohio Network put out a couple weeks ago. The same document in press release form is on our webpage and also on our blog. So that was Saturday. I then went from there to a gathering over in Lorain, where I was really had the privilege to speak, to honor actually a guy, just a tremendous person named Paul Hassan, an imam from Massillon, Ohio, but who has been in Lorain, gosh, since I think the mid-80s. He is a stalwart community activist, a founding member of the nationally known organization, the International Council for Urban Peace, Justice, and Empowerment, which has worked with gangs or street enterprises to broker truces around the country. He's been very active in Lorain, having founded the official Lorain County Organizing Committee for the Holy Day of Atonement. He is at countless vigils for victims of violence in the community. He has successfully brought together for, 25 years, just about people of all races, religions, economic backgrounds to work for equality, justice, and equal empowerment for all. He's also focused and has particularly tried to lift up a younger generation of leaders and is just a tremendous human being who is incredibly committed and incredibly aware of what's going on around him, both in his immediate environment, Lorain, Ohio, but in the larger community. So had an opportunity, along with many others, to say a few kind words about the work he has done in Lorain, and he has certainly been a close confidant in working with us. He is on our AFSC board and has been a real asset in helping us move in the right direction to expand our awareness of peace and justice and self-governance in all of its forms. So that was Saturday afternoon in Lorain at a event to acknowledge the Holy Day of Atonement, but also in particular to lift up the good works of Imam Paul Hassan. So that was on Saturday the 17th. On the 19th, Monday, there was a meeting of individuals who are concerned about the issue of poverty. It's an ongoing gathering of open public meeting. Next one will be on November 9th, of people who are planning an anti-poverty economic justice rally in March to coincide with the Republican National Convention. We've been meeting for about, 4 or 5 months now. Well, maybe 3 months, I guess, 3-4 months. And continue to meet now a little more frequently. Next meeting will be in a few weeks. We'll announce that closer to it. In Lorain, trying to develop a specific now as we are call with some specific issues and demands that we want to raise up during what will be the first day of the convention on July. That would be Monday, July the 18th. So if you have a 2016 calendar and you are in Northeast Ohio, scribble down the afternoon of Monday, July the 18th for a march and rally on the issue of poverty and economic justice on what would be the first day of the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. Details of where the initial rally site will take place and march route and all of that is to come, but that's what we're talking about, and certainly the planning meetings are open to all. On the 20th, that would have been Tuesday, was the latest meeting of the Radio Free Akron. Not just a board meeting, but a public meeting in the afternoon that took place at the Labor's International Hall on Wolf Ledges in Akron. check out our Facebook page, radiofreeakron.com. Plans are on the move. We are very confident that certainly before the end of 2016, we will be on the air, and that air will be 96.9 FM on your radio dial. It's a micro, low-power FM station, so you're going to have to be in Akron or just outside of Akron in the case of some parts of Cuyahoga Falls. Our radius will only be maybe 5 to 7 miles in every direction with an antenna in downtown atop a building on North Union Street. So our frequency is 96.9, Radio Free Akron, WMVU. We are Many Voices United. And we've got some real dynamic people. We're just putting in electrical in the next week or two. Our office studio is shaping up quite well now. Still working to raise some money, so if you've got a few extra dollars you're willing to donate, go online, go to our Facebook page, Radio Free Akron. There's a link to where you can donate, help out the cause. We still need somewhere in the order of 10 grand or so, but we're moving in the right direction. And if you have anything you think you can help out with, feel free to give us a call at 330-928-2301. All right. Thursday, last evening in Shaker Heights, was a showing sponsored by the Shaker Heights Move to Amend of the film Legalized Democracy that was put together last year by Move to Amend National. It coincided with their fall sort of re-kickoff of their campaign. The Shaker Move to Amend group is trying to gain ballot access to a Move to Amend initiative to call on their congressperson to end corporate personhood and the bizarre notion that money is free speech. They need somewhere in the order of 1,000 valid signatures to get on the ballot. They have already, they started several months ago and have already collected somewhere in the neighborhood of about 850 signatures. So they are well on their way, but still are looking to collect, just for a cushion, probably another 400 to 500 signatures, and would like to do that before the horrific barren tundra winter weather sets in Northeast Ohio within the next month or two. So if you can help that cause, give our office a call. We'll put you in touch with the Shaker Heights Move to Amend people, 330-928-2301. It was a very good meeting. There were a number of students there, probably about 20-25, in fact, from Shaker Heights High School government class, a couple of whom themselves are circulating petitions among seniors who are got to be 18 years or older to sign the petition to be able to vote. But they're working that crowd, and the Shaker Heights Move to Amend regular members are working the community. So if you can help, whether you live in Shaker Heights or somewhere else around, you don't have to be a member or a resident of the group or of the community to circulate a petition. Certainly you would be welcome to do that. And again, give us a call, and we would be more than happy to help them out by putting you in touch with them. Well, so those were the events that took place last week. And I should say that both Carla Rautenberg, who's on our board, AFSC, and myself spoke following the film, giving sort of a wider context of what happened in the case of Carla in Cleveland Heights, since she was one of the coordinators of that successful Move to Amend Citizen Initiative campaign back a couple of years ago. And I commented a little bit on what's going on nationally and the importance of working on this issue. Well, turning now to events coming up this next week. Only a couple of them, but a couple very important ones. Next Tuesday in Oberlin, I will be on a panel discussion that will be addressing Ohio Issues 2 and 3. The event is sponsored by the League of Women Voters of the Oberlin area and the Oberlin College Forensic Team. It will be at Craig Auditorium on Woodland Street in Oberlin at 119 Woodland from 7 to 9 p.m. A number of speakers will be talking about both State Issue 3 that calls for a particular proposed amendment to create a certain amount of labs that would provide marijuana for medical purposes and the like, and issue two that addresses the issue of monopolies, oligopolies, and cartels, but also deals with just in general amendments affecting quote-unquote commercial interests. So about five or six speakers will be speaking on one or the other, or maybe both. I, in particular, will be talking about issue two. So if you're anywhere around Oberlin next Tuesday, want to hear about the connections and the relationship between issue two and corporate centralized power and authority, feel free to take that event in, 7 to 9 p.m. Craig Auditorium, 119 Woodland Street in Oberlin. You can go to our website or Facebook page for a flyer to download. So that's next Tuesday. Next Wednesday, there will be a meeting, open meeting, of the Northeast Ohio Move the Money Coalition, which is a gathering of organizational representatives, but just also concerned citizens about our skewed, misplaced, immoral, insane federal budget priorities that continues to favor weaponry and occupations and wars and a very narrow sliver definition of national security at the extent of healthcare security, education security, infrastructure security, housing security, and so many other forms of security here at home that would provide many more jobs and make us much more energy independent than the current system we have under now that is just promoting wars and empires abroad. So the next meeting of that Move the Money Coalition will be Wednesday at 4 p.m. at the new offices of Peace Action in Cleveland, which is at the Pilgrim Church, 2592 West 14th Street. So that's Wednesday, 4 p.m., Pilgrim Church, 2592 West 14th. Finally, just a general announcement, not a specific event, but as previously mentioned, concerning Shaker Heights, there are a number of Move to Amend movements that are on the move right now in several Northeast Ohio communities that if you live in or anywhere near, they would certainly be more than happy to welcome your involvement and support. And where there are activities that are right now in the midst of are besides Shaker Heights, as previously mentioned, Kent, which has a ballot measure in November in a couple of weeks, Cleveland, which is gathering initiative signatures to get on the ballot in 2016, and South Euclid, which is a week from Saturday, I should say 2 weeks from tomorrow, which would be November the 7th, going to be launching their citizen initiative drive to get signatures to get on the ballot in 2016. So these are ongoing movements. If you live in any of those communities or near and want to help out, give us a call. We'll put you in touch with those particular contact people. However, if you aren't in any of those communities but would like to see some Move to Amend movement in your community, also give us a call. We're here to help. We'll put you in touch with others in your community and help you develop an exploratory meeting and try to get some activity going in your part of the world. So give us a call, 330-928-2301. Well, we now turn, as we do every week, to comment briefly. It's always hard to make these comments brief, but we'll do my best on several issues from this past week that AFSC here and elsewhere addresses. The first is a article that came my way a few days ago, written by a guy named Michael Snyder, that was entitled Goodbye Middle Class. 51% of all American workers make less than $30,000 a year. Based on a new report that the Social Security Administration released, there are some very troubling numbers. And of course, those numbers reflect real people and real living conditions. But here are the numbers, as troubling as they are. that speak to the growing plight and economic challenges that more and more people in this country face. Yes, 51% of all American workers make less than $30,000 a year. However, 38% of all American workers make less than $20,000 a year. That number is truly staggering, given that the federal poverty level for a family of five is $28,000. Yet, almost 40% of all American workers don't even bring in $20,000 a year. Incredibly troubling. One more indication that we're not anywhere close to getting out of the last economic recession, as we are traveling very quickly toward the next economic recession. But of course, even these numbers are only reflective of those individuals who are actually working. When you realize that there are millions of individuals who are either officially unemployed or have just stopped working altogether. And some recent figures show that 7.9 million working-age Americans are, quote-unquote, officially unemployed, with another 94.7 million working-age Americans that are considered to be, quote, not in the labor force. When you add those numbers together, you get a grand total of 102 million working-age Americans that do not have a job right now at all. So what are their economic conditions like? How much are they earning? How much are they bringing in? It's very, very troubling, the conditions that we face. And the solutions, of course, are ones that have to, in some way, counter some of the causes for these declining economic conditions. Certainly, technology has resulted in displacement of workers. Capital mobility, in which capital companies are able to pick up and move elsewhere, or even if they don't move elsewhere, can use the threat of moving elsewhere to drive down wages of workers. You also have increasing right-to-work measures in states around the country, as well as, you know, basically there are no right-to-work. So it's misnamed. It's not right-to-work. It's basically right to be unemployed. These laws in different states around the country, and certainly the ability of companies to play off state workers in one state against another, or one country against another, gives them incredible leverage that can drive down wages and drive down income. So you've got these factors that are at play, labor laws that are at play, and other factors, trade deals that make it easier for capital to get up and move elsewhere, is in play. The solution, of course, is to, you know, there's only so much that can be done on one level. So long as capital has the ability to move the way they do, there's, in a sense, only so much that can be done. But what can be done certainly involves some public policies related to taxes, spending, and monetary changes. We can employ tax policies that try to move some dollars out of the pockets of the enormously rich and put those into public jobs programs that create public employment that pays a living wage. Spending policies certainly can reflect that. Monetary changes that reward less bankers that have quantitative easing, if you will, for the public, for the people, and not just for bankers. We can create certainly monetary changes that take the power out of the hands of banks and put them in the hands of our government and of we the people, so that we have money that's being created and that therefore can be spent to hire people to repair a nation's infrastructure that would certainly permit more workers, and incredibly millions of workers, to earn a decent living. We can certainly make sure that trade policies like the TPP and others are not enacted that create some kind of control and regulation on the ability of capital to move wherever they want to do, want to move. We can work at the state level and at the municipal level in trying to increase minimum wages. and to create, in fact, living wages. Of course, preceding it all, undergirding or overarching, besides these tax spending, trade policies and changes, and living wage laws and labor law changes, are basic political and legal changes that have given, that have anointed well-to-do people and corporations with all of these powers and rights that have resulted in them to have the ability to distort and to manipulate and to influence our legislators and our laws toward their benefit. So a few things that can be done, that need to be done, to try to address these problems. Well, a second article that came my way was actually a review in the LA Review of Books of a piece called A New Golden Age by Tom Streithorst. And there's several parts to it. The third part in particular of this, if you go to the LA Review of Books, this was October 13th of this year. Part three of his three-part review was called A New Golden Age, The Basic Income Guarantee. And this is certainly yet another way to sort of deal with people who are struggling to make ends meet and simply are not earning enough to survive. It would be to create a law to change policy, spending policies to be sure, that provides a basic income guarantee, a floor, to every citizen, every American in this country. It has ancient pedigree, as the author Streithorst says. It's advocated in the Bible. It was proposed by Tom Paine. It was, in fact, almost put into law by President Nixon. The idea is to give every citizen enough money, a basic survival income. Unlike typical welfare payments, it would be unconditional. Everybody gets it, rich, poor, worthy, undeserving alike, you, me, the homeless guy, sleeping under the bridge, as well as Rupert Murdoch and others, would get the same monthly payment. If you are unemployed and get a job, no worries, your government grant stays the same. And it doesn't demand that recipients use it wisely. It's just like regular money. You can spend it as you wish. Think of it as Social Security for everyone, Streithorst says. It's not, however, he goes on to say, just a left-wing idea. Nixon proposed the basic income guarantee to Congress back in 1969 because he figured it was the best way to eliminate poverty without creating a huge, large federal bureaucracy, which is, of course, what we've acquired. Conservatives and libertarians supported this idea of a basic income guarantee because it enshrines individual choice and keeps the nanny state to a minimum. Progressives liked it because it empowers the poor and lessens inequality. After all, nothing liberates people at the bottom like money in their pockets. Streithorst goes on, and basically he just says, I like it because it's the most efficient way of increasing demand. In other words, he goes on to talk about, you want to jumpstart the economy and get business going and get companies producing stuff. They're not going to produce goods and services if they know nobody's out there to buy things. Why do you think, in looking at the media now, you're seeing a downturn in places even like Walmart, even like McDonald's, are laying off people en masse? And part of it is because there simply is not enough money out there, just money supply in general and circulating throughout the economy. Those dollars that people do have, more and more of them, people are just sitting on, afraid to spend because they are afraid of what's to come. But the truth of the matter is, most people don't even have enough to spend. They aren't increasing and causing demand to occur that results in supply by business to be created. So the solution, at least according to Streithorst, to get the economy going again, as well as for these moral reasons, is a basic income guarantee. Now there's people on either side, some legitimate discussion on either side about, well, should it be conditional, unconditional? Should it go, in fact, to everybody, including millionaires? We can have an honest discussion about that. The concept, though, of a basic minimum income is one that hopefully will be one that more and more will become something on the table for public discussion. Well, a third piece, real quick, is an article concerning a court case that was decided a couple of weeks ago, in which a panel of federal judges overruled EPA on their allowance of a bee-killing pesticide. A panel of federal judges has rejected the EPA approval of sulfoxaflor, an insecticide that acutely is toxic to honeybees. This particular insecticide is made by Dow Chemical Corporation, and it's designed to kill pests on a variety of crops, including citrus, cotton, strawberry, soybeans, and wheat. But as the EPA itself has acknowledged, the insecticide is also acutely toxic to bees. Now, why would the EPA approve such a pesticide? Well, basically, they claim that the key is to limit its exposure. It's okay if they allow the Dow Chemical Corporation to produce this stuff that goes to farmers who apply it at a certain time before there are blooming and the petals fall off and the like. So in of itself, EPA was claiming it's not lethal to bees, depending on how far in advance before bees start coming around to pollinate, it is applied to blossoms. Well, environmentalists didn't agree with that. They challenged a ruling of EPA, took it to court, and the court said, we agree with environmentalists. We want you, the EPA, to go back and revise your regulations, and then we'll see where it stands. And basically, our concern about this is not so much over the environment or over bees, although we certainly are concerned about both, but we don't particularly as an organization work per se on the environment, but where we come down on this is looking at this through the prism of democracy and self-governance and the role of what EPA is, which is a regulatory agency. Here is just one more example of a regulatory agency that, like all regulatory agencies, is designed to regulate certain occurrences. And if you look back at the history of regulatory agencies, going all the way back to the Interstate Commerce Commission of the 19th century, can't remember exactly what year now, that agency, 1880s, I think it was, that the ICC, Interstate Commerce Commission, was created, the very first regulatory agency to ostensibly regulate the railroads. And it was eventually created with the blessing of the railroads. Why? Because the railroads believed, you know what, being regulated is a whole lot better than not having an industry at all. Because at the time, there was strong push to having nationally owned railroad companies, publicly controlled railroad companies, not private. So the railroad industry said, you know what, it's far better to have this quote-unquote regulatory apparatus that's created that can serve as a shield, that can be as a go-between between us and the public, that when the public doesn't like what's going on, they can come and complain to the regulatory apparatus and not to us. We are protected, and we are shielded, and we can still make a very healthy profit, but still be in existence, versus having public control, which is certainly would spell the death knell to privately owned entities. Well, we're not advocating, and I'm certainly not advocating there being publicly owned chemical corporations, but rather that EPA, as many regulatory apparatuses are today, serve and continue to serve as that shield. They tend oftentimes to regulate activists more than regulate corporations. They regulate how much poisons are going to be in the environment versus to prohibit poisons in the environment. And certainly this is an example where environmentalists are saying, no, this insecticide, sulfoxaflor, I think is how it's pronounced, is not safe in any amounts. The solution is not to figure out how many parts per million is sort of the magic number under which is safe for bees. It's that the whole bloody insecticide is dangerous for bees. It needs to be abolished. It needs not to come in to be introduced into the natural bloodstream into nature in general. EPA, as many regulatory agencies are, do serve a certain purpose and positive purpose, but oftentimes they serve a very detrimental purpose in shielding us, we the people, from corporations who at one time we directly controlled and authorized through charters to directly determine what companies could and could not do, not through some surrogate middleman, if you will, through regulatory agencies. This was one of the three ways that corporations, in fact, sought to escape democratic control and regulation, one of which was to shift decision-making from the local level to the state level, or from the state level to the federal level, or now from the federal level to the international level. That's what these so-called misnamed trade deals are about. That was one way to escape control. Local control is certainly, you know, you as a citizen have got a lot more power and authority and influence over your local public official than you do state. And you've got a lot more influence and access to your state than your federal and so on. So one of the ways corporations sought to escape control was to move decision-making upward or downward, depending on how you want to look at it, from one level to another, from one level where people or citizens had greater access to the next level where they had less access. The second way they sought to escape democratic control was to shift decision-making from the legislative arena to the judicial arena. Corporations sought to say, we don't like this democratic control coming through state legislators. We got to shift it to the courts. And by shielding themselves and building a moat around themselves through court decisions, aha, now we're protected from the dangerous democratic legislative bodies of state legislators, of city councils, of federal congresses, which, of course, corporations these days have pretty much captured, but still, relatively speaking, is more democratic than judges, than courts, where there's fewer of them in number. You can always have the anointment of, oh, it's constitutional, you can't do this. It's an even greater barrier. And of course, if you have elected judges, you can buy off or influence those judges. There's only a few of them, so it's much more efficient for corporations to buy off or rent or retain 5 or 6 or 9 judges than it is a whole army of legislators. It's a lot cheaper to do it. And then finally, so that's the second way. And then the third way, of course, that they sought to escape corporations' democratic control was through the creation of regulatory bodies. The Interstate Commerce Commission being one, but the whole panorama of regulatory agencies today. A way to get activism funneled away from going after corporations and corporate controls through these sort of middlemen, through these surrogates. They serve, if you will, as almost, using a football metaphor, we are in the fall, football is on the minds of many, these regulatory agencies serve as sort of the offensive line, protecting we, the people who are defensively trying to defend our communities, defend our lives, defend our families against the quarterback, the corporation that is doing this passing game, this running game, is assaulting, along with the other players, the wide receivers and running backs, trying to assault our communities. The offensive line is the regulatory agencies too often, many of which have been partially or wholly captured. Many of the employees of these regulatory agencies used to work or, in fact, are being promised a job once they act in the right way to regulate, quote-unquote, the harms and causes of who they are supposed to be regulating. Problems inherently, we have to constantly, with vigilance, keep our eyes on these entities and understand that this, yes, to a certain extent, there is some positive role to be played, but there is also some danger to be had. So that is third piece. Lastly, it's related, of course, comment, not so much a news story, but just sort of an observation. It is one that I call the other capital punishment. You know, there's a number of states over the past month or two that, for a variety of reasons, are putting on hold, including, as announced this week, the delaying of capital punishment for largely a couple of reasons, but mostly having to do with the lack of access of the chemicals necessary to adequately and humanely sort of an oddity saying, but to humanely kill persons who are to be injected with these chemicals as they are clamped down in a chair somewhere in Columbus or elsewhere. Well, there is another kind of capital punishment out there that we need to pay some attention to. It's not the version that we are thinking about these days, not the human version, which says that we should have a law or not have a law that ultimately takes the life of a person that has committed a crime so heinous that we feel as a society that person cannot be rehabilitated for. That's the conventional form of capital punishment, is it not? That's not the type of capital punishment I'm talking about, nor the political version of capital punishment, which exists in some places at some times, arguably, maybe it's even occurred in our country, where people are put to death over their political views, and particularly their call for revolution. Some can say that, some might say that the deaths of Sacco and Vanzetti in this country more than a century ago was an example of political capital punishment. And certainly around the world, people are put to death for challenging the state in fundamental ways, calling for significant change, revolution, overthrow. That's not the type of capital punishment I'm talking about, but rather what may be called electoral capital punishment, the kind that basically says that if you don't invest sufficient financial capital in the political process, you will be punished. Not literally you personally being punished necessarily, not lashed, not jailed, though maybe, in fact, it is true if you happen to be the head of a financial corporation, a banking corporation that was responsible for, in part, the financial implosion of 2007-2008, which, of course, was caused by these financial institutions that were involved in lots of speculative ventures, as well as trying to get people who could not afford to purchase homes to, in fact, purchase homes, or who engaged their companies in a variety of illegal practices like robots illegally signing mortgages or building into mortgages something called ARMs, adjustable rate mortgages, where you pay a very small interest rate the first year or two, but then it balloons the third or fourth year. You know, if you're a person heading up a financial corporation, then certainly this kind of capital punishment would be very directly related to you because, of course, you want, and in fact is true and has been true over the last couple of years, where financial CEOs contributed a tremendous amount of money to make sure to politicians, particularly at the federal level, to ensure that they, in fact, were not personally punished, were not personally put in jail, were not indicted, were not put on trial for charges that they were responsible, that they knowingly and that their companies knowingly, intentionally targeted low-income people for home purchases and engaged in a variety of illegal and, if not illegal, then immoral practices. So that certainly is an example of personally trying to avoid punishment. But basically the kind of capital punishment I'm talking about is one where the issues you care about are not being heard if you don't weigh in financially to public officials at the certainly federal, but to a great extent anymore also state level, and even to some extent local level, that your voice is not being heard, your needs are not being met, your community is not being helped. It's a punishment of ignorance. It's a punishment of neglect, if you will, that if you are not these days weighing in and investing huge amounts of capital, of money, in the political process, in candidates running for office, creating these attack ads, getting so-called issue ads out there for voter consideration, that there will be punishment that comes down your way, maybe again not directly to you personally, but to your community, to those issues that you care about, to those solutions that you are advocating that are not being heard or not seriously being considered. It's a punishment of ignorance, a punishment of neglect, a punishment that is becoming wider and deeper and will never end, this form of capital punishment. Not until we forget about trying to elect or unelect certain individuals or create certain kinds of laws, people or laws will not abolish this type of capital punishment. Only amending the Constitution to end corporate personhood and money as speech will do it, which is yet one more reason why we need absolutely to create a constitutional amendment and to do what we can to support the Move to Amend effort. Well, that's all for this week. Keep up with our activities. Contact us with questions, concerns, or willingness to help out. Give us a call at our office, 330-928-2301. Our website is afsc.org/Akron. Visit us on Facebook. That's NEOAFSC. Our program blog is northeastohioafsc.wordpress.com. My blog, createrealdemocracy.wordpress.com. Until next week, onward for justice, peace, and democracy.